This is KZSU Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. Our topic today is women and madness, especially in literature, and what a copula that is. How far back does the "and" of women and madness go? All the way back to the crazed women of antiquity haunting our unconscious. The Medeas, the Medusas, the Furies, the Harpies, the Maenads. They all still rave inside of us, Antigone along with them. Such is the power of archetypes. They endure, their stories reiterate, they take on ever new incarnations. I've said it before on this program, almost all the archetypes in our collective unconscious were discovered by the Greeks. No one knows exactly why. Shakespeare maybe added a couple of new ones to the conventicle. Ophelia of the Willows, for example. She's the type of a more tender kind of madness. The madness of an infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing. Ophelia moves us rather than terrifies us. Her passive, helpless, profoundly wounded folly marks her as a modern rather than a classical feminine type. Stay tuned, friends, a show about what happens to the figure of the mad woman across the 20th century coming up. Ophelia, incapable of her own distress, climbing a willow tree that grows aslant a brook, its branch falling into the river, with Ophelia on it. Let me take this occasion to call on Comrade Arthur Rimbaud, whose voice we haven't heard for quite some time on Entitled Opinions. When he was 16 years old, Rimbaud wrote a poem about Ophelia that remains one of the most exquisite of the modern French canon. Here's how it begins. Sur l'onde calme et noire où dorment les étoiles, la blanche Ophelia flotte comme un grand lit. Flotte très lentement, couchée en ses longues voiles. On entend dans les bois lointains des alalis. Voici plus de 1000 ans que la triste Ophélie passe fantôme blanc sur le long fleuve noir. Voici plus de 1000 ans que sa douce folie murmure sa romance à la brise du soir. On the calm, black wave where sleep the stars, white Ophelia floats like a great lily, floats very slowly, lying in her long veils. Far off in the woods you can hear them sound the mort. For more than 1,000 years, sad Ophelia has passed, a white ghost, down the long black river. For more than 1,000 years, her sweet madness has murmured its ballad to the evening breeze. Ophelia, ô pauvre folle, she was made for poetry, made for opera. Speaking of opera, I'm joined in the studios of KZSU today by Maria Masuco, an eminently sane young scholar who started training as an opera singer. While on that path, she fell in love with the Italian language and then with Italian letters, and then fell in love with our Italian studies program here at Stanford, where she recently earned her PhD in Italian literature with a remarkable dissertation about what happens to the figure of the hysterical woman across the 20th century, and in particular about how various Italian women writers have reworked and recast the figural tradition of sick, neurotic, or languid female characters into something quite different from the standard fare. Maria, welcome to Entitled Opinions. I'm glad you could join us today.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
The topic of madness and gender is a huge one, to be sure, But I'm curious about the rather tentative thesis I threw out there. It didn't sound tentative, but I, in my mind, it's still tentative that Ophelia, the character from Shakespeare's Hamlet play, is a more modern, more gentle, more tender, passive, modern, feminine type of the mad woman. Do you think that there is this distinction between a figure like an archetype like Ophelia and those of the ancient world where you have those mad, raving women?
That is a kind of deep and complex but perfect place to start, I think, for a discourse on madness and gender, because really what we're doing is we're looking at two categories of mad women and two binary manifestations of madness. And so you have the side of rage and you have the side of violence and wrath and really fear-inducing figures that leave a kind of scar of terror, but also absolute fascination in the imagination. And then you have the haunting, as the poem that you opened with so aptly depicts, this haunting figure of the depressive, the one who slips away into nothingness in response to the maddening circumstances, rather than being incited into a rampage. And so I think the way that you are dividing this between the ancients and the moderns is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that the reason that our modern world struggles so much with gender and madness is because those two manifestations of madness have been allocated along the gender binary as well. So one of the reasons it's been so difficult historically to really treat and aid in manifestations of madness is because they're instinctively attached to correctness or incorrectness of sexuality. And so there's been a bit of an admiration, or let's say a fascination, a kind of positive fascination in a way, with the more masculine type of the manifestation of madness, that angry, violent lashing out. And that's been pedestaled in a sense in the way that our stories uphold those figures, despite often their punishment in their own storylines. And then there's the more effeminate side of depression. And whenever someone who is along the masculine side of that gender binary manifests the more effeminate version of that madness, that's not great in a patriarchal society, obviously, to be classified along the feminine side. So what you've opened up here with a bunch of these really evocative archetypes is it's complicated from the get-go. But for some reason, women characters are always going to be the ones showing us the different options for the manifestations of madness. And that's what I find to be really fascinating.
Can you give an example of how things get confused when you have a male depression that takes on what was conventionally considered feminine characteristics?
Yeah, there are obviously cultural codes across history that allow for different behaviors along the different lines of the gender binary. But the one that starts to influence, or that started to influence my research in particular, was thinking about shell shock and thinking about people coming back from experiences with warfare and combat.
In the First World War, particularly.
Especially in the Great War, yeah. And the overwhelming evidence that there was something going on here, and it being buried very actively, in a way trying to cure it through more combat, putting people back on the lines, back in contact with these hyper-masculine considered activities, and then really not wanting to face the aftermath of the psychological damage that was going on. So what we get much, much, much later in the 20th century with the Vietnam War, really, is a reckoning with people coming back from combat and saying, my mind is still there. And it happened to be a cultural moment in which society was ready to confront something such as PTSD. And so retrospectively, we've been able to do a lot of considering of what former generations were seeing and calling by something, some other name. But definitely gender and madness in terms of battle and hand-to-hand combat and violent altercation, it's a very thorny and deeply culturally rooted topic.
There was outright condemnation of people who suffered shell shock after the First World War or during the First World War, and they were considered cowards and or effeminate.
Emasculated,
indeed. But the phenomenon was so undeniable and widespread that I think it caused at least some psychologists, Freud included, to begin to investigate, you know, what kind of disorder, what kind of wounds trauma can actually inflict on a subject.
Absolutely. I think that's really the turning point that my research hit upon, which was it turned from a project on madness into a project on woundedness by way of research into trauma. And it was an undeniable move, because when I read a work by Judith Herman, Trauma and Recovery, in which she really points out the fact that there are forms of trauma in the world that are publicly accepted as traumatic, and war is one of them, you know. And so Freud, as you mentioned, witnessing this widespread experience that's an undeniable thing that these people are going through, and then also witnessing the personal aftermath of this more collective experience, was able to connect the dots. But Freud witnessed another instance of widespread psychological aftermath, and in Judith Herman's analysis of what Freud does when confronted with claims of child abuse and incest and molestation, Herman points out that he did not make the same strong, courageous connection between a collective social experience, an interpersonal experience of trauma, and the validation of the claims of these people who are experiencing PTSD. And that takes decades. It takes decades, and it takes feminist movements way later in the 20th century in order to validate. And that's why I became so fascinated with the hysteric.
Well, you're pointing there to something maybe I can clarify a little bit for our listeners about this rather controversial move that Freud decided to commit himself to from his early analysis of female hysteria as having its roots in real sexual abuse in childhood by older father figures, if not the father, uncles, right, older brothers, one way or another, a real social event, as opposed to his shift by putting all the etiology of female hysteria in the psyche and in the realm of the fantasy of the false memory of women. And I remember when I was a graduate student there in the 80s of this book by, I think, I don't remember his name, even Mason or Masson, who wrote a book called The Suppression of the Seduction Theory in Freud, in which he took Freud to task for displacing the etiology from the real world of real trauma into a merely fantasy life. And as a result, I think that you were suggesting that Freud did not want to accord the same sort of reality to trauma in the case of women who had been perhaps indeed sexually abused in their youth, as he was willing to do so in the case of soldiers suffering from shell shock.
Yeah, I wouldn't put all the onus on Freud, honestly, because if you think of the scope of what he was encountering in terms of claims and what he would have had to put forth and support, of course, he did have the potential. He did have the studies, the interactions with the patients, and also, perhaps most importantly, especially according to contemporary day workers in psychology, he had the responsibility and the trust of these women who were sharing their stories and believing that he would believe them. But to make that claim and to support that explanation would have been, as it is today, world-rending.
In fact, that's the thesis of that book about the suppression, is that he realized that if psychoanalysis was going to be accepted in the Vienna of his day and age, it was not going to be accepted if you were exposing a scandal of actual widespread prevalent sexual abuse in the bourgeois families of Europe. And therefore, it was the way of domesticating the whole phenomenon by putting it into the psyche.
And how ironic, right, that someone who had the capacity to really open up that world and in the heyday of hysteria ends up reenacting the exact same diagnosis which we're getting all the way from the Greeks, which is there's a wandering uterus here enraging this woman and driving her completely out of control of her husband, of her community, of her family, and of herself. And what's our solution? Heterosexual sex and pregnancy. We need to root that uterus back where it belongs. And we're getting diagnoses such as these passed along from Western culture to Western culture across the centuries. And there it is, yet again, in Freud's Vienna. I find that to be really telling.
So we go from, there's three words in play, madness, then trauma. As you said, you started investigating trauma. And then you realize that maybe trauma is not specific enough. And the word that you have in the title of your dissertation is woundedness. It might not be as elegant as madness or trauma.
Right.
But the word itself is wounded as woundedness.
Yeah.
Would you say, just to conclude on the Freud, that Freud was eliding the woundedness, namely the real wounds that provoked hysteria among the women's?
That's exactly what I was hoping to say with that word choice, yeah. And the word itself, as you say, it lacks all elegance. It lacks the same sense of category, in a way. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a word that would point a finger at the fact that there's something really urgent and physically present about each of the stories I was going to look into.
Right. In which way did your work follow in the line of the feminist scholarship that was investigating these phenomena, and in directions that you felt needed correction somewhat, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of an interesting two-arrow pointing towards the second wave feminists. In the one hand, from the beginning of the 20th century, pointing towards these feminist scholars in the 80s mostly, who are going to go back and re-examine the texts from the early 20th century, from the late 19th and the early 20th century, and say, look at how symptomatic these texts are of their cultural milieu. Look at how much the hysterical woman is actually constituting the center of signification.
Now, which texts are you referring to here?
So I'm speaking of things like Madame Bovary, you know, the classics with this crazy women at the center.
Jane Eyre.
Yeah, exactly. And also a bunch of the decadents, really looking at someone like Barbara Spackman, who takes a really good hard look at these decadent writers and takes a look at D'Annunzio and says, these texts have nothing at their center without the sense of malady attached to femininity. And by looking at the way these feminist scholars were doing a somewhat psychoanalytical but also a social critical rereading of these early texts, I was very inspired. On the other hand, I was inspired by the fact that these feminist literary scholars were doing something that today's psychologists and critical literary scholars were not as much doing, which is being activists. They were really interested in saying, no, I'm not at all a neutral reader. I am very much a part of a consciousness-raising circle. I'm very much a part of a movement to improve the justice of the sexual order that we have around us in terms of employment justice. They talk in all of their introductions to their books and their conclusions and their acknowledgments about how important their own personal experiences were in reading books in a certain way. And I found that to be exactly where I wanted to go with my investigation. It's not neutral. And yet at the same time, it was a very, very careful look at what the texts were saying, both about their own economy and about the way these figures were being inherited and then passed along to a new generation of literature that would be the post-World War I era that I was looking at.
At the same time, Maria, there's this sense that we're still stuck in the world of literature, namely the world of the imagination and characters who don't have a measure of reality, as opposed to a woundedness which is not a literary phenomenon only.
Mm-hmm.
It's represented in literature, but that there is still to this day, perhaps even more today than ever, when I read the newspapers on a daily basis, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe, in Italy a lot, the systematic abuse and wounds that women of all ages are subjected to in bourgeois society. It's not just literary characters who are susceptible to this phenomenon of...
You mean patriarchy?
Well, I think the patriarchy is the framework within which all this abuse takes place. So I'm just curious where it stands in your mind, this distinction between literary history and the role of women in literary history, where we're talking about fictional characters, and then you were referring to the activism of these feminist scholars
who
were still committed to trying to change structures within the real world that would either improve the conditions that led to neuroses or involved with something else. I'm just not sure how you understand that relationship between the real and fictional.
Mm-hmm. I want to keep all my parts in order here, but the primary statement in response to that is that as a literary scholar, following in the footsteps or attempting to learn from the work of these other feminist literary scholars, I think there's an underlying belief that stories and representations of experiences have concrete impacts on the lives of real people. And especially when we consider the strength with which we've inherited certain stories and figures, the strength with which they permeate our cultural understanding of the world we live in, and the difficulty of either uprooting them or adjusting them in some way. I'm still debating with myself whether we ever really can even modify the stories that we inherit, let alone get rid of them. There was something in approaching these representations that I thought was in direct, let's say, direct attack on that kind of relationship. The fact that the stories that we tell about our world do impact our world. On the other hand,
vice versa too, no?
Absolutely. The world we live in breeds, and the stories we tell emerge from the world we live in. Yes, it's definitely a two-way street. But the other hand of the other side of the coin is that these instances that literature is so capable of recounting, these, let's say, close studies or case studies, this intentional deep dive into the intricacies and the details and the circumstances of singular lives, is exactly what we need in order to push back against the generalizing gesture of attaching madness to femininity and just letting the story end there.
But would these stories have to be written by women authors?
No, absolutely not.
So my understanding is that you read Madame Bovary and you say, well, this is a male's representation of a woman who might have inclinations towards this madness, and therefore it has to be rewritten and reconceived and recast because it's not an author who is speaking from within the experience of.
So let me clarify. One of the things I found so inspirational about these literary critics, there's Naomi Shore or Janet Beiser or also Christina Mazzoni is among them, that are working with French and Italian texts, is that they weren't actually out to denigrate or denounce these male writers as doing something wrong or being simple misogynists who we never needed to pay attention to again. They were pointing out the features of the literature that we love that were also helpful in unearthing the aspects of our society that we don't love. So it's not that the men are doing it wrong. It's that there's a whole discourse on who has access to literary prominence, and that's a separate discourse, right? That is an entirely separate can of worms of patriarchy and the economy of literary markets. But what they're looking at instead is, these are great books. They're doing certain things. The stories are also telling us certain things about how women are in the world. And then if we also start to pry open the specificities of their conclusions, they're either going to end up dead, pregnant, and married happily, that way they're tucked away, or in extreme cases of subversion, mad. And they found that to be fascinating, right? They thought that these male authors were actually showing us something about trends in the world and about what we find fascinating in literature as readers across centuries.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question about opera. I've said it, and people get annoyed when I say that I'm opera-phobic, precisely because I find that so much of opera is at the pitch of hysteria, whether it's a male voice or a female voice. Mm-hmm. It's always this operatic drama where you're at the edge of madness. How much of your experience in your training as an opera singer nourished your fascination with that kind of edge at which sanity is threatened to plunge into insanity?
So much. So much. And maybe it's not the reason you would assume, but behind the scenes of the experience of singing opera is the pleasure of walking the line of the crack. And I mean, perhaps the most commonly recognizable manifestation of this is Pavarotti, who cracked on his high notes almost as frequently as he nailed them and held them for eternity, right? And that quivering between total downfall and disaster and just nailing something absolutely divine is the generative force of live opera. But for the one who's doing it, it's the sensation of being in front of a crowd, equally ready to do something that no one else in the room can do and wants to see you do, and something that will absolutely tarnish your image as a divinity of song. So that's the one side of it. The other side is that mad scenes have been the center of stage art for centuries, especially when you go back to the origin of the female diva, who the mad scenes had almost nothing to do with the plot, but they were written in there for the express purpose of being able to tear at one's clothes and sing really high and do a lot of movement with the voice. And so that kind of eccentricity, the idea that opera makes space for, at the center of its spectacle, the wildness and the hysterical pitch of the portrayal of madness has always been really captivating to me. I think because as one who performs it, you have the sense of control instead of the sense of that wildness. Opera is putting on for its public absolutely controlled uncontrol.
And this makes me think of, I've written about rituals of mourning and grieving. I know that you're familiar with some of that work of about the voice of grief, where talking about trauma, the loss of a loved one, a very important loved one, it could be the father or the husband, where traditionally there was a complete loss of emotional control and a risk of descending into at least momentary madness with grief, pulling of one's hair. My sort of thinking about it led me to conclude that a lot of the highly ritualized protocols for grief, which enact the scene of uncontrolled emotion, the beating of the breasts, the pulling of the hair, the scratching of the face, all these behaviors that you find as far back as Homer in his characters, Achilles, and when he loses Patroclus and so forth, and that you have still today in professional lamentations in southern Italy, for example, that is a highly choreographed enactment of grief in order to protect oneself somewhat from the crazy spontaneity of despair and threat of madness.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't agree more with the idea that the simple understanding of the fact that something is staged does not negate the power of its enactment. And I think that we see that in a Ferrante novel with the figure of La Poveretta, who's this woman who is left by her husband. And then she's just known for the rest of her existence, literarily, as the woman who ends up killing herself out of despair for the fact that she's been completely abandoned and her entire sense of self-worth and really purpose is taken away from her along with the fact that her husband leaves. But the way that that figure is employed in a novelistic setting is ritual. It's a point of reference. It's a point of reflection of one's own experiences and feelings. And so I think there's something in our discussion about opera as well about, and yet, even if we know that this is all being put on, it's, you know, at the pitch of hysteria, we are still in the space with sound vibrations that are far higher and far faster and far more intense than what you experience in your daily life. Well, hopefully you're not experiencing that level of screaming in your daily life, but and it does something to you physically. It does something to you orally. I think that has a place in our world.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, in fact, being abandoned by a husband, there's different ways of being abandoned. He can either leave you or he can die, and vice versa. It throws you into a crisis. So that's very good. In your dissertation is titled Woundedness and Reintegration, and then the Phenomenology and Transmission of Women's Trauma in Modern and Contemporary Italy. So first question, reintegration, what do you mean by that?
Good question. So reintegration kind of comes from a Jungian sense of getting back in touch in some way with these archetypical forces that can root or center a person's sense of wellness. But I don't really go too deep into that in the space of the dissertation. Really what I'm mirroring in that title is Judith Herman, again, the work Trauma and Recovery. And Herman in 92 is the first one who lays out a step-by-step process based on really extensive qualitative studies of people's experience in therapy and in therapeutic settings that they can actually move towards a world in which their trauma is no longer determining their physical circumstances. And so what I wanted to do with the final portion of my project was focus on what are Italian artists doing today that no one's done before in terms of depicting madness in women and characters, but then also using the tools of their art form to propose some manner of togetherness, some manner of betterment or process towards health. And that was a really fun portion of the investigation.
How do they go about doing that? Mm. Because you mentioned therapy. I tend to be skeptical about how much the talking cure can really do. And when you're talking about profound wounds and trauma and just sitting on it. But it sounds like what you get in literature is a different kind of therapy, a therapy that reaches much deeper into the soul and somehow, perhaps, if I understand you correctly, makes you feel that you're not alone in your own affliction.
Yeah, the first step in writing about this and thinking about it was to recognize that stories that simply offer the Ophelia-style ending are not really making you feel like your story has a scope of transcendence or recovery. And it really encourages, in a way, it depends on the reader that you are, I think, but in a certain way, it encourages the centering of the experience of death and hopelessness as the story's end. So that becomes kind of a cyclical experience of despair. The novels that I wanted to focus on were ones that addressed a particular interest of mine, which is what do we do about matricide? In the context of women and madness, there is such a contentious debate about the importance of having negated for so long the goddess, having negated for so long the importance of the mother, and having foregrounded for so much of the 20th century things like penis envy or things like the fact that all ailments that women are complaining about are rooted in their own femininity, and therefore there is no way of finding solace or connection in the mother, and actually it's the killing off of the mother that allows the young woman to step into the role of being a man's new partner. All of the damage that those complex standards are setting out needs in some way to be rectified. And the way I wanted to go about looking at that rectification is by looking for stories that did something else. And so I studied stories in which daughters are narrating and they're looking at the wounded bodies of their mothers. And this connects directly to what you were talking about earlier about rituals of mourning. It's not about the mother not dying. It's about realizing the physicality and the particular woundedness of the mother in proximity, physical proximity to the daughter, having no one else in that space. And there are an impressive number of 20th century novels that do just that. They stage an encounter between the maturing daughter and the wounded body of her mother. And there's something incredibly therapeutic about those scenes. It's not denying in any way the experience of suffering of any of the characters. It's actually foregrounding it and then making a literary space in which nothing about a woman and man relationship matters in any way. And the thing that is centered is the recuperative, dignified acknowledgement of the bodily similarity between the two women in the room. And that was really an amazing, I
think,
discovery.
These kind of confrontations are frequent in Italian literature?
I don't know about frequent. I mean, I have a unique
canon.
Yes, you do. But I think what's interesting about them is that they are present in the most prominent novels by women from the Italian 20th century. And that is worth noticing, right? These aren't obscure novels.
And are these confrontations between daughter and mother benign? Because here's another question. They're not. Because why is the mother-daughter relationship so difficult, so filled with sometimes self-destructive mutual accusation?
That's a huge question. I mean, part of it is what I was just referencing earlier in terms of the way patriarchy really punishes bonds between women that are not existing in a more submissive way, either solely for the purpose of assisting each other in maintaining the domestic space, or passing from the role of innocent virginal daughter directly into the role of pregnant wife. And there's really no socially sanctioned safe space for the mother-daughter relationship to develop outside of those dynamics. These are generalizations, obviously. But what novels start to explore, or even perhaps just narrate more of, especially Italian novels in the 20th century, because of the unique way that Italy goes through the post-World War II years, is the multitude of ways in which young women are living things like companionship, things like work, things like sexuality, things like relationships with their mothers. And so the Italian feminists of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s are really acutely aware of the need to reshape or at least re-theorize this relationship with the mother away from all of that negative history that it's accumulated. And that's where they're very inspirational to me.
That negative history also takes the form not only in literature, Italian literature, but also in relations within the family, where the daughter does not want to become what the mother has become by virtue of her having been the victim of a patriarchy that has, in a sense, led her into an impasse and a condition of impotence and this desperate desire to avoid the fate of the mother,
right?
I think creates a lot of antagonism in that relation sometimes.
Yeah, there's the saying, legare la propria catena, so tying the daughter to the mother's own chain, which I think breeds resentment on both sides, obviously.
So if listeners are intrigued enough to want to read a few of these novels that you have in mind, are there any titles that you would be able to offer that be available in English?
Yeah, actually, it's very exciting. The central novel that I explore in kind of the second phase of my research is called Menzogna Sortileggio, which is by Elsa Morante. And previously, I would not have recommended it to English reading listeners, but we have been treated to a brand new translation in English this summer. And so it's now out as Lies and Sorcery. It's quite a volume. It's a big one, but it is one of the most remarkable novels of the 20th century, bar none. And I highly recommend that. Morante is also cited as being the grandmother, let's say, of Italian contemporary literature, and she's a huge influence on the globally popular Elena Ferrante, who is also one of the figures that I study in this project. I also would recommend the novels of Goliarda Sapienza. She's difficult to categorize, but she has an incredibly distinct voice, and a lot of her writing is semi-autobiographical. You can't go wrong with Sapienza, for sure.
Sapienza is And is it translated into English?
Most of it.
As Sapienza?
No, that's the author's name, Goliarda Sapienza. The primary novel would be The Art of Joy. The Art of Joy was completely ignored in Italy when it came out. And then the French picked it up several decades later, and since then it's had a real boom. So she's writing in the 60s and 70s, and then it's not until the early 2000s that she really comes into prominence. But The Art of Joy is another spectacular novel. And then the final section of my study of recovery is more about cinema, believe it or not. I take a look at contemporary Italian film, building off of this idea that motherhood needs a good look. It needs a whole new set of depictions.
Great.
Yeah, Lies and Sorcery, The Art of Joy, and then probably The Days of Abandonment by Elena Ferrante is one I go into a lot in my studies.
Yeah. In addition to other books of hers, right?
Of course, yeah.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Maria Masucco, who is a PhD graduate from our own Department of Italian Studies here at Stanford and who is now teaching literature at Sacred Heart in Menlo Park, Atherton. So we're delighted you're still in the area and part of our ongoing community here. I began by making some comments about Ophelia, so I think I'm going to end with a song called Ophelia that reprises many of the themes we've been talking about, Maria. So thanks again for coming on to Entitled Opinions.
Thanks so much for having me, Robert. It's been a joy.
Take care.
night. I trust you enjoyed the fight. My father's gone missing, and the boy I've been kissing is the one who put out his lights. They told me that you were unkind, that you thought the whole world was blind. There was all of that chatter that you're mad as a hatter. Now it's me